Hey there, it's Gary Parrish. It's Wednesday, January 30th, 2019. Welcome back to the Eye on College Basketball Podcast, where we sometimes discuss camel fighting. And Leaky Black, Matt Norlanda is here with me. And I want to open on the Big 12 because it's been an interesting past 2 days in the Big 12. On Monday night, Baylor went to Oklahoma and won by 30 to extend its winning streak to 5 games. So Scott Drew's Bears are now 5-2 in the league, tied with Kansas State and only Kansas State atop the Big 12 standings. And that's because Kansas lost 73-63 Tuesday night at Texas. So the Jayhawks are now 16-5 overall, 5-3 in the Big 12. But the even more concerning thing is that KU is now just 4-4 since Udoka Azubuike suffered a season-ending hand injury, and they're just 1-5 in road games on the season. So let's start here. Norlander, you have consistently said you will not pick anybody other than Kansas in the Big 12 until KU's string of at least a share of 14 straight Big 12 titles is broken. But right now, Kansas is tied for third in the Big 12 standings. The Jayhawks are trending in the wrong direction, and KenPom currently projects Iowa State to win the league outright and snap KU's streak. Question, are you ready to abandon Bill Self? Are you ready to say KU's streak of Big 12 titles is coming to an end?
Question, where did you have Iowa State picked in the league?
Answer, couldn't possibly remember something
answer,
like that.
Answer, I know it. It was sixth. I had him second. How we doing? Good morning. I can't believe it's been 3 days since we had a podcast. This week is flying by. I will not abandon my post. I'm still going to stick with this. I think this is the language I've used in the past, but I will make it crystal clear as we start this Wednesday podcast. I will not pick Kansas to not finish atop the league standings in the Big 12 until it doesn't. There have been a couple of instances over the past 14 years where they have finished atop the league standings and actually shared a regular season title with a couple of other teams. I think that outcome is actually now most likely. I'm not going to give up on this. I'm just not going to abandon it. And as you're mentioning this, I was thinking about it yesterday because I knew we'd talk about this. Earlier in the season, I refused to abandon Villanova. And then I feel like you kind of talked me into abandoning Villanova, and now look what's happening. So the same thing is applying here. I know in the aftermath of losing a road game at Texas, it's feeling like it's never been this much in jeopardy for Kansas. Maybe that's true, but I got to see it to believe it. And I also think Big 12 big picture-wise, I'll get to Baylor in a second, but I want to throw it back to you first. Big picture-wise, the Big 12, I don't think the winner is going to get out of this without at least 5 losses. At least 5. Right now, Baylor and K-State have 2. Texas Tech, which is bouncing back nicely, has 3. Kansas has 3. And Iowa State has 3. I would say it's even relatively possible, maybe not likely, but if we look up, we see 3 teams wind up finishing with 5 losses atop the standings. And if that indeed does happen, I think you're going to have some people out there that are going to refute the Kansas 15 straight years. But the record really is consecutive years finishing atop the league standings in the regular season, tie or no tie. I won't give up yet. And with Kansas, if you can take – now, it's easier said than done, and Texas was able to do this to a certain degree, thanks in part to Jackson Hayes, who is a raw talent, but if he wants to leave after one season, he will leave and he will be a first-round draft pick. Having a guy like him on the floor certainly had an impact, and you can't get anything else consistent there. They didn't even start Lajero Vick last night. Ochai Agbaji started. He was fairly decent, but they're not getting enough around him. They're just not getting enough help overall. And so now I wonder, I playfully wonder, and yet I know there will be some heavy cynics out there, will Silvio D'Souza be ruled eligible or not in the coming days here? Seth Davis, our colleague at CBS and who writes for The Athletic, maintains that it's coming like by the weekend, essentially. Will he get eligible? And if he does, how much will people lose their minds if Kansas gets D'Souza on the floor? There's also then the question of, like, all right, getting him back is important, but is it really going to be the difference or not? We will wait and see on that. But man, that was not a good performance. And now Kansas is, you mentioned the 4-4. I'll extend the stat I mentioned on the previous podcast. All their losses have come on the road. They are 1-5 in road games. Haven't lost at home. Haven't lost on a neutral floor, so there are some bright spots here and there. But yeah, this is a slipping Kansas team, and as they enter February, lots of doubt is out there. Oh, I can't wait to readdress this come the end of February, though, because I can see it so clearly. We'll look up, and they'll have some 1-game lead in the standings.
I would you say that The winner of this league is going to end up with at least five losses. I think five losses, meaning if you only have five losses in the league, you're going to win the league outright. I think six might even win it outright. Certainly six, I would assume, would at least share the title. And I'm not going to freak out about the conference standings. Like, that's the thing I've seen some people focus on, since Tuesday night, which is, Kansas is now 5-3 in the league, a game behind Baylor, a game behind Kansas State, tied for third with Texas Tech in the win column. I don't care about that because we've actually seen Kansas make up ground, throughout February in years past. We've probably done at least one podcast episode each year where Kansas is trailing somebody or no longer projected to do this or that. And we ask these same questions that we're asking right now. We talk about the same stuff we're talking about right now. And then, just like you said, you look up in late February and Kansas has got a 2-game lead and they're, a weekend game away from clinching at least a share of the title. And we still got a week left in the season, whatever. To me, the more concerning thing is that they're not very good without the guy that they lost. And so you can look at big picture and go, hey, they're 16-5 with 12 wins over top 100 KenPom teams. The resume is still very good because the resume still is very good. But the dude they used to build that a lot of that resume is not available now, and he ain't going to be available. Like, talking about Kansas from November 6th to today is kind of pointless. If you're going to discuss Kansas intelligently, you really got to start talking about them since the moment Doak suffered that hand injury, and they're 4-4 with two losses to unranked teams in that stretch. And they were an underdog last night at Texas, and the line got pushed up. In other words, it like opened at Texas -1, and by tip I think it was around 2 or 2.5. And then they go lose by 10. And that's a Texas team that is still is good in the computers, but they entered that game 11-9 and losers of 5 of their last 6. So, like, what oddsmakers did was evaluate Kansas based on what Kansas has been and concluded that Kansas should not win a game against a team that was 1-5 in its past 6 games. To me, that's the most concerning thing here is that Kansas looks very average without Udoka Azubuike, and I think last night was another reminder of that.
Yes, I agree, and it's why the seemingly pending news of Silvio D'Souza I think does have relevance and potentially an impact. I'll also note that earlier this week, the NCAA determined that Miami junior Duan Hernandez had entered into an agreement and accepted benefits from an agent with basically Christian Dawkins. This was a tertiary connection to the FBI case, and the NCAA ruled that he couldn't play this year or 40% of next season. Hernandez subsequently declared for the draft. He'll never be playing for that school again. So if people are wondering about that case, and maybe it will indicate that Silvio D'Souza might necessarily be eligible, listen, it's the NCAA. Anything is possible, but the way that we know D'Souza and his guardian to be connected to this case is not the same circumstances that Miami's Hernandez was. So as you wait for that, keep that in mind. I don't feel super strong predicting one way or another in this, but I'm not exceedingly confident that D'Souza will get eligible. If he does, I think he can make an impact. But Parrish, you're on the money. Just in terms of Doak, how much he meant, how he helped Lawson overall, and you can't ask Lawson, even though I'm sure he would love to do it, to give you 29, 15, 5 assists and 3 blocks every night. It's just not sustainable. And now, if you look at the Big 12 real quick here, I mean, Texas wins, right? Huge win for Texas. Huge. Instead of 11-10, 12-9, and a big-time victory, only their second since January 5th. They also have wins over North Carolina and Purdue, has lost to Radford at home. There are some real weird resumes out there. I won't say Texas has the weirdest one because there are some weird ones, and we've hit on some of those in the past month on the pod. But Texas is growing to something that I can very much see Texas being one of those teams We get seeming like one of them every 4 to 5 years about in the tournament, where you look up and you, and when they get in the tournament, they've got like they're 3 wins over 500 or 4 wins over 500 total. And from a record standpoint, it just doesn't look right. But when you dig into the resume, you'd have a hard time kind of keeping them out. I think Texas is trending toward that overall. So that was a big win for Shaka Smart's Longhorns.
Let me say one thing about Silvio's situation at Kansas, because like you, I'm not confident predicting either way, if only because you'll look dumb more often than smart if you start trying to predict what the NCAA is going to do in any case, because they're wildly inconsistent and they do not follow their own precedent. But I do a regular spot every Tuesday in Kansas City, and I was asked about it on Tuesday. And one of the things I've said is that I feel this is such a complicated case, because with Dewan Hernandez at Miami, you can say that the penalty is excessive, especially if you believe the reports that the improper benefits that he accepted amounted to less than $500. Like, if you want to say the penalty for that is excessive, I'll agree with you. If you want to say that amateurism rules that prevent things like that are ridiculous, I've been yelling that for years. But he did knowingly violate NCAA rules. You know, he knew what he was doing, and he got caught, and so there's a price to pay, whether you agree with the rules or not. Just like whether you agree with a speed limit or not, if you are in a 45 driving 65 and you get caught, there's a price to pay for it, even if you think that it's all ridiculous. With Silvio's situation, it's a little, to me, more complicated, because I think everybody acknowledges that something outside of what the NCAA rulebook allows happened, as it's connected to his recruitment, and presumably that is why he ended up at Kansas as opposed to Maryland or somewhere else. But there's also no evidence whatsoever that he knew that what was happening or allegedly happening. It seems to have all happened above his head. And so I'm sympathetic to that. The idea that a student athlete would have things, games, seasons, perhaps, maybe college careers, ripped away from him because of something that he wasn't involved in, he didn't know about, he didn't approve of. Like, that all sucks. And so I'm sympathetic to that. And it's why, if the NCAA grants him his eligibility, allows him to play for Kansas again, I won't scream and yell that this is the worst thing ever, because even though I don't think I would rule that way, I'm sympathetic to his very specific circumstances. That said, if the NCAA says he's never playing at Kansas or college basketball again, I also won't scream and yell about that, because I don't know how you enforce amateurism rules if you are going to ultimately say, well, the student athlete didn't know what happened that led to him enrolling at Kansas, therefore we're not going to hold him responsible for what happened that led to him enrolling at Kansas. Because what that leads to, if you want to go down the slippery slope thing, is basically it's a cheat sheet for everybody in the country. Hey, you know, here's a shoe company, here's an assistant coach, here's an agent going to give you $50,000, $150,000 to go play basketball at this school. The money's going to go from this person over here to your guardian or grassroots coach or high school coach or father or whomever. And you just don't need to know anything about it. If you're ever asked about it, you just say you don't know anything about it. And then just like Silva de Sousa at Kansas, you'll be allowed to play again. You probably won't get caught. We probably won't get caught. But B, if you do get caught, you just have to shrug your shoulders and say, but I didn't know, and everything will be okay. Like, again, I hate amateurism rules. The concept is outdated. It's morally wrong. But as long as the rules are in place, I don't see how you enforce them if you allow players to play even though their amateur status is compromised just because they there's no evidence that they knew what was happening. What do you make of all that?
I largely agree with you, and I think that Kansas is going to try and make the argument that any benefits that were afforded to him have been paid for retroactively in what would have amounted to game suspensions, though he did play last season, and that I think that also, like, the status of D'Souza is not just will he play, will he not. Will the NCAA hand out a similar suspension than it did Hernandez? I would believe that whenever we find out more about this, the NCAA also has to determine if it's going to bring any sort of potential judgment on Kansas for playing him last season, and if that violated anything, and if so, what Kansas might stand to lose from record vacation, among other things. But the greater point you make there is level-headed and accurate. You know, whenever we do get news, it might be in time for our next podcast. We'll wait and see. We'll obviously react accordingly. But in terms of on the court, Parrish, getting him back, I think if they do, yes, it's a help. But I, you know, however you want to slot Kansas right now, if you want to say Kansas, let's just, you know, let's say Kansas, you have them as the 15th best team in the country, guys. I think that's where they were on KenPom when I looked last night. Getting D'Souza back doesn't, to me, that very inclusion doesn't jump them from 15 to 5. Maybe it makes them, you know, 15 to 12 or 13 or so. There are other factors that they need to get better with, most notably the freshman Dotson and Grimes. This is why we sometimes take Duke and Kentucky for granted, because they can rely on their freshmen to do so much. And Kansas, in many years, which has had great ones, don't get me wrong, but it's no guarantee. And if they were playing more consistently, then Kansas wouldn't be in this position.
Let's talk about Baylor for a second. 14-6 now, 31st at KenPom. They're on a 5-game winning streak. This is a team that started the season 3-2, 6-4, 8-5. 0-1 in the Big 12, 1-2 in the Big 12, and now they're 5-2 in the Big 12, tied atop the league's standings. I know you talked to Scott Drew after the Bears, like, won by 30 at Oklahoma, which is just ridiculous. Like, nobody in the country should win by 30 at Oklahoma. Not Duke, not Virginia, not anybody, and yet Baylor goes to Oklahoma, wins by 30. I texted with Scott late Monday. It really, this is one of the, I mean, we focused in recent podcasts about, you know, the twists and turns of a season, usually the turns in the wrong direction. Right now, Ole Miss is that. I think Auburn is probably that. But you talk about twists and turns turning upwards, like really taking what looked like it was going to be a bad season. I mean, you can go into the archives of this podcast, and at one point we were discussing the Big 12 and said Baylor is probably going to finish last in the Big 12 because it was a sensible thing to say at the time. And now we're sitting here on January 30th and Baylor's tied for first in the Big 12. Really is a bit of off the radar story, but still a remarkable story in college basketball.
Yeah, it is. I think Baylor had the most surprising January of any major conference team. And now it's zipping up into the top 40 in the net rankings, and has 5 quadrant one wins. It is doing this, so it's interesting because we talk about what Kansas can and can't do without Azubuike. You know, if you want to evaluate Azubuike as their second best player, I think that's fair. Baylor does not have its best player. In fact, has not had Tristan Clark, its best player, since right before its last loss, which was Kansas, coincidentally enough, on January 12th. Since then, since losing Tristan Clark, Baylor is 5-1, has won 3 road games, including, as you mentioned, the relatively shocking 30-point win at Oklahoma. And Scott Drew is building a case for Big 12 Coach of the Year at this point. We'll wait and see what happens. Here's what's fascinating to me about Baylor. I want to see how they play out through February, because they'd be in the field if they started today, NCAA tournament field, that is. That wouldn't have been the case if we had done this podcast 3 weeks ago, really even 2 weeks ago. They wouldn't have quite had the resume. But this is now, because Clark's gone, he was their 6'9", kind of do-it-all power forward. This is the smallest team by far in the Big 12. And Drew told me it's, you know, smallest team he's ever had. This is the second most shocking season as it's unfolding that he's ever had. The only one that was more surprising was 2009-2010. That season, Baylor was picked to finish 10th out of what was then a 12-team Big 12, made the Elite Eight, and had a really, really talented team, turned out. This season, Baylor was picked 9th out of 10th, and now you look up, it's tied in the standings with Kansas State overall. But it's such a small group. It starts a 6'5", quote, center. And it is on pace here for the fifth consecutive season to be a top 10 team in offensive rebound percentage. We'll see if it can keep that up. Obviously, the Big 12 has some serious bigs and front court presence. And that Baylor is a zagging team while much of the rest of the league is zigging. So they're gonna hit some skids here, but even just getting to the tournament would be incredible. Just a note on Baylor, Scott Drew. They are worth at least hitting on at this point. They're in Wednesday's court report among some other stories as well on CBSSports.com. Check that out. But it is truly remarkable what they've been able to do and how they've been able to turn it like this, because almost nobody saw this coming, and now to do it without their best player is even more, frankly, Parrish, it's ridiculous. Like Drew said, he even thinks it's a little bit crazy at this point, but he's riding with it, and hopefully it'll be able to sustain itself.
I mean, that's like what he told me. He was like, I can't make sense of this. Like, but the players are playing well, and it's a lot of fun to be experiencing what they're experiencing. One thing worth noting, and this probably goes without saying, but I'll say it anyway. The Big 12 has 8 top 35 KenPom teams, which is just like ridiculous. I mean, 80% of the league's in the top 35 at KenPom. So it doesn't matter how well you're playing or how well you've been playing lately. I think what we've already learned about this league is that everybody is susceptible to multiple game losing streaks. So you can win 5 in a row and feel like you've really got some stuff figured out, and then next thing you know, you take a loss to a top 35 KenPom team at home. Then you go on the road as an underdog against a top 35 KenPom team. You take a loss there, and now you're right back where you were, you know, 2 weeks ago. And so Baylor is obviously still susceptible to that. But I would argue literally everybody in the league, Kansas included, is susceptible to that. And it'll be an interesting, perhaps the most interesting power conference race to watch going forward. Grant Williams had another nice game on Tuesday night. We're going to talk about that and the Player of the Year race next. But first, check this out.
If you want to win your fantasy football league, it starts right now. The offseason is the best time to get ahead of the competition. We'll help you win your league on the Fantasy Football Today podcast, part of CBS Sports Podcast Network. Fantasy Football Today has 3 episodes every week following the latest news, giving you early rankings, early sleepers, breakouts, and busts. So if you're a dedicated fantasy football manager, check out the most dedicated podcast, Fantasy Football Today. Download and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere podcasts are found.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
So Norlander, your Player of the Year rankings start with Duke's Zion Williamson, obviously. But number 2 right now, you got Grant Williams, the reigning SEC Player of the Year. And he got 23 points, 9 rebounds in a win at South Carolina on Tuesday night. And shouts to Tom Hart, who shouted out both Devin Downey and Chester, South Carolina on Tuesday night's SEC Network broadcast. Tom's a legend now, forever, like Terry Teagle. How much fun was that? Tom Hart dropping a Devin Downey, Chester, South Carolina shout out on the broadcast.
Tom Hart, we hope / think you were listening. Thank you. If you can work one in one more time this season, that'd be incredible. That was I had the game on, but I had the quad screen and I didn't have the volume on that one. So I didn't hear it as it happened, but then, you know, obviously people hit us up, and then our own Kyle Boone actually captured the video and shared it. That was fantastic. That was a nice little surprise there. South Carolina couldn't get it done against Tennessee. Frankly, they needed Devin Downey on that floor last night. But regardless, no, that was a cool moment. And Grant Williams continues his strong case for Player of the Year. I think he has to be in anyone's top 3 at this moment.
The game tipped at 5:30 Central, so I was still on radio when it happened, so I didn't hear it live either, but I started getting Twitter hits about it moments after it happened, and shouts to Kyle Boone for capturing it. Shouts to Kyle Porter, too, while we're
of course
on the subject. Shouts to Kyle Boone for capturing it and sending it out into the social media world. And Dave Pasch, if you're listening, you're now on the clock. We need a Larnell shout-out during an Arizona game ASAP. Norlander, Grant Williams, he's now averaging 20.4 points, 7.4 rebounds, 3.4 assists, 1.6 blocks, 1.3 steals in 31.4 minutes per game for a Tennessee team that's 19-1, ranked number one in the country. He is better, statistically speaking, in basically every way you measure things this season. And again, he was the SEC Player of the Year last season. So I don't want to say anybody's got anything locked up in January, but I'll be shocked if he's not the SEC Player of the Year again. Do you give him a real chance to catch Zion? Can anybody, perhaps even Ethan Happ, catch Zion in the Player of the Year race?
It's possible. Because I don't want to Heisman ourselves here. I feel right. College football media, not all of them, but just a certain contention to the point where it when we hit mid-October, it feels like a discussion point frequently, maybe not annually, but frequently, where there's a particular player that seems like a foregone conclusion, and then you fast forward to that whatever first or second Saturday in December, and you see that in fact no, it wasn't the player that we thought. So it's possible. It's certainly possible because of the fact that RJ Barrett, I think, would need to be on the top 10 of any overall Player of the Year ranking list at this point. And if Zion still continues to be awesome, but RJ Barrett, you know, hits another level in terms of how much he's scoring, and maybe Zion's numbers trend back a little bit, they steal votes from each other, then it opens the window for a player like Grant Williams, who is. Parrish, I'll say this. Grant Williams seems more of a lock to win Player of the Year in his conference than Zion does Player of the Year nationally. You look around at the rest of the league, and even though Williams is similar to Williamson in that his own teammate, Admiral Schofield, isn't lagging too far behind, I think what he is doing right now is Grant Williams, what he is doing is so impressive. Tennessee is so good, and yes, I still, you know, still going to take another loss, two, maybe three, before we get to the SEC tournament, but still, he's got a stranglehold on that. You mentioned Ethan Happ. He leads the court report in that. Ethan Happ hasn't been discussed as a Player of the Year candidate to this point. Maybe inside the borders of that famed cheese state over there in the Great Midwest. And our shouts to everyone listening to this podcast enduring insanely cold weather in Wisconsin and Illinois and Minnesota, wind chills approaching negative 50 and 60 degrees. We hope this podcast is warming your hearts and your ears. But Ethan Happ has not been discussed, and he really should be. And it's not just because he's only 1/1,000th of a point behind Williamson in KenPom's Player of the Year formula, which is certainly notable. You mentioned Grant Williams is up across the board basically in every major statistical category. Ethan Happ is averaging career highs in almost every major statistical category with the exception of two. I'll get to that real quick in just 1 second. But right now, Ethan Happ is on pace and averaging north of 17 points, 10 rebounds, and 5 assists. No Big Ten player ever has done that, and it has been at least 22 or 23 years, and it might even be longer. I have not been able to suss out and figure out if it happened when and where in the early 90s or 1980s. A player period in the level of all of D1, 17, 10, and 5. Doesn't seem that grand, but it just simply does not happen that often. In fact, there have been very few cases I haven't found. Bill Walton, Larry Bird have done it. I'm sure there are a couple guys in the 80s, but the fact is Ethan Happ is the only dude right now flirting with that. And when you consider how valuable he is to Wisconsin, this is now a top 25 team in the rankings. It's obviously it's doing well, won four in a row, trying to bump up against Michigan and Michigan State in the Big Ten standings. Everything that he does just about needs to have him at the forefront of the conversation. I would actually get him closer now to the top five versus where I had him almost a week ago. Last thing, Parrish, and I'll throw it back to you. The weird thing with Ethan Happ is this. He doesn't shoot three-pointers. And he's terrible at free throws. He's never been worse at free throws. He's shooting now below 50%, but he doesn't get taken out of games. And I talked with him about this, and he said that he's gone through so many different shooting coaches and mechanics and routines, and he actually settled on one he liked in the preseason, but once it failed him in the first few games of this season, he abandoned it and made the problem even worse. So now he's trying to get back into that. Hopefully he'll be somewhat consistent when we get to March. The ironic thing is the first 12 games of Ethan Happ's career, he was shooting nearly 80% from the foul line. It got progressively worse as a freshman. Then things really got out of hand. He's gotten worse and worse and worse. So he's this awesome, amazing player, one of the best ever in Wisconsin history, and yet this is this huge, glaring flaw. We wait and see if it winds up costing Wisconsin the tournament or not. But overall, I think you got to say Ethan Happ right now, a top five player of the year candidate, because all the numbers and historical trends suggest that he is.
I don't know how closely you look at player efficiency ratings, but Zion's got the best in the country right now by a significant margin. It's 43.36. Closest to him, like number two in the country, is 37.24. So he's more than 6 points higher than anybody else in the country in terms of PER. Number two, by the way, is Brandon Clark at Gonzaga. Gonzaga's interesting in the sense that the leading returning scorer on the team is Killian Tilly. The guy most people say is their best player is Rui Hachimura. And then the guy with the best PER is Brandon Clark. So when you got those, when you can check those three boxes with three different people, who's your best player? Who's your leading returning scorer? Who's got the highest PER? When you check those three boxes with three different players, you've got a hell of a basketball team. It's why I don't think Gonzaga is going to lose again before the NCAA tournament, and maybe not lose again all year. Like, it's not crazy to me to think that they could win the national championship. Let me ask you this. Is Mario Šajak on your player of the year radar at all?
He's on the radar. I didn't have him top 10. I actually had Brandon Clark over Hachimura because I think he's doing just a bit more right now. Šajak is. I think Šajak still leads the Big 12 in scoring, and he is an important factor. But I watch Iowa State and how skilled they are 1-5, GP, and Talen Horton-Tucker is top 10, top 12 freshman in America. Tyrese Haliburton is the most effective and efficient freshman because of how well he shoots the three. So anyway, long way of answering it. He's on the radar, but I don't think he has a realistic chance of finishing, say, first-team All-American, which means he doesn't have a chance of winning it overall because he's got a lot of help around him, and it's going to be him or Dietrich or Jarrett Culver that wins Big 12 Player of the Year.
One thing I would say in his defense, as it pertains to possible first-team All-America stuff, he's averaging 19.7 points per game right now in 32.2 minutes per game. And remember, Iowa State's projected right now at KenPom to win the Big 12 outright. If they do that, then he's going to be getting proper national attention. Because like, if Iowa State goes and wins the Big 12 outright, Iowa State's going to end up being a top 10 team, mm-hmm. probably. And then you got a guy averaging 19.7 points, 5.1 rebounds for a top 10 team that just won the Big 12 outright. Interesting. He's shooting 51.4% from the field, 41.0% from three-point range, 86.5% from the free throw line. And I got this from Iowa State, I guess it was a few days ago. Since the 2009-2010 season, only seven players have averaged at least 19 points while shooting 50, 40, and 85. And Mario Šajak right now is on pace to become the eighth player in that span to do it. And so if he does that and Iowa State wins the Big 12, I do think he'll have a shot, at least a shot, to be a first-team All-American. Before we get out of here, I want to talk about St. John's for a minute because they play on Wednesday night. They're at Creighton. And I believe the last time we talked about St. John's, it was all positive stuff. You know, they were in the top 25. We had said in this four-game stretch, if they could go 2-2, that – you know, you'd take that if you were Chris Mullen. I believe they did in that four-game stretch go 2-2. Let me confirm that real quick.
They did, yes.
They did. So they lost at Seton Hall. That was that weird game with the bad ref stuff happening. Then they beat Marquette at home. Then they won at Georgetown. Then they lost at Villanova, but only by 5 points. They were sitting there 14-2 overall, 2-2 in the league. And we were like, hey, this is all good stuff. Since then, they've gone 1-3 with losses to DePaul and Georgetown at home. The other loss coming at Butler. They're at Creighton on Wednesday night. And Mike Vaccaro, the accomplished and awarded columnist at the New York Post, wrote a column after the Georgetown loss, like basically saying, listen, like, does Chris Mullen have the whatever, you know, have the goods to get this thing turned around? Because right now it's not looking like he does. I'll ask you, do you think Chris Mullen gets this turned around? And if he doesn't, the implication from Vac, at least, was that if he can't win with this roster, the way he needs to win with this roster, then he's just not built for the job. What do you think all of that's fair? Like this St. John, well, we were talking about twists and turns, right? I mentioned Ole Miss. I mentioned Auburn. We mentioned Baylor going up. St. John's is a twist and turn in the wrong direction.
It's totally fair, especially when you look at the Big East this year, which is weird. The margins are thin. Almost 50% of the league's games have been decided by 6 points or fewer, 18 out of 38 league games so far. So the conference below Villanova and Marquette is extremely interchangeable, which means it's there for the taking. And when you look at the roster St. John's has, there's little excuse for it being as behind the ball right now as it is. In fact, here's a bad sign for St. John's. It's just barely cracking the top 50 in the net. It only has one quadrant one win. It is the only team in the top 50 that has two losses or more in quad three or quad four and only has one quad one win. The most similar profile to St. John's is probably St. Mary's, which isn't sniffing the NCAA tournament if it were to start today. So that's not a great sign at all. And now it's staring down and a near impossible gauntlet in terms of it's not going to win three in a row. St. John's is not going to win at Creighton on Wednesday night, at Duke on Saturday, and then at Marquette the following Tuesday. That's all in less than a week's time. You got to get at least – you need at least one. And the easiest one is Creighton, and that's not an easy place to win, period. Stealing it at Duke, Parrish, they did it last season, but the game was at home at MSG, and St. John's had that weird back-to-back Duke and Villanova. And then actually, I remember I beat Marquette as well after that. So it was a nice little three-game stretch. Asking for that two seasons in a row, particularly when all these games are on the road, is too tall a task. Hope that you can somehow steal both at Creighton and Marquette, have that talent show up. The Duke score is whatever it is. Get out of there at 2-1. You're going to be in much better shape. 0-3 is more likely hope, or 0-3 is more like hoping you get to 1-2. But yes, putting Mullen's job on blast here, I think, is validated at such a critical point in the season. And there was a clip that went around on Twitter, and it might have been elsewhere. I don't know, but it's not the worst thing in the world, but it's just not a great look for Mullen in that it's a timeout in a critical game against Georgetown, critical spot, and you've got the assistant Greg St. Jean with the whiteboard directing the team. You know what? Sometimes assistants run huddles. This isn't out of the norm, but it looked like Mullen was just not involved in the timeout period at that point.
He was tying his shoe, not even like engaged at all. Like right. Again, you're exactly right, and I do think that's worth pointing out. Assistants run huddles. I don't want to say all the time, but that's not abnormal and doesn't necessarily mean anything. But when Mullen already has a reputation of not being involved, engaged, and then that's on national television, like critical moment, critical game, your assistant's doing everything and you're just like tying your shoe. Now, I get it. Like, you know, but listen, your shoe comes untied, you need to tie your shoe. I'm sure that's what Chris would say. But it was like, it wasn't a great visual.
It wasn't, and it was a microcosm, I think, for some of the concerns that St. John's fans have. So I thought this team would get into the NCAA tournament without much of a challenge, frankly. I thought by the time we got to the start of February, it would have taken on some losses, but it was going to be top three in the Big East and comfortably trending toward it. But it's lost at home to DePaul, which is an issue, and the Georgetown loss is an issue. If you turn those losses into wins, we aren't having this conversation, frankly, on the podcast, because they'd be in a much better spot. But that's not the case. They're 15-5. They're not 17-3, and their non-conference schedule was it rated horrendously. I mean, it was really rated as one of the 20 or 30 worst in all of college basketball, and it could be a problem overall. And it's why St. John's was never ranked, despite the fact that it started 7-0, 8-0, 9-0, 10-0, never cracked into the polls at that point. We'll wait and see. It started well up to 12-0, but it is gone sideways there. Real quick, Parrish, I have a trivia time for you, if I may, since we talked about
time.
That's right. Trivia time, since we talked about undefeated. So Houston was the first team to 20 wins. This is also more in-depth stuff here. I got a lot of stuff on the court report, people. Please give it a read. So Houston beat the field to 20 victories. And I had, as my mind sometimes works in weird ways, a wonderment, a curiosity that I was hoping to fulfill, and I did. I wondered how often the team that gets to 20 wins first does in the NCAA tournament, wins the national title, makes the Final Four, etc. You can find out all those answers in Wednesday's court report. My question for you, Parrish, is this. Since 1996-1997, there have been two coaches that have done it twice. Only two coaches are on the list twice, first to 20 wins. Can you guess which coaches those are?
John Calipari.
Incorrect. He did it only one. Did he ever do it?
I don't
hold
know.
Hold on. Hold on. He never did it. No, he never did it.
Really? He wasn't the first to 20 wins ever, even when he started like 30-something and 0?
Correct. Now, that can be a factor of the calendar and the schedule, but John Calipari at Memphis and at Kentucky has never been the first to 20 wins in a season.
That seems ridiculous. He's had the last undefeated team at least two times.
Yep. Crazy, but true. Okay.
But I trust you.
thank you. But the,
Mark.
Yes. Mark Few is one of them, and then the other guess isn't that hard as well, although it's a little bit tricky, but it's not a hard guess.
Mike Krzyzewski?
Nope. Duke has never been the first team to 20 wins. Incorrect. I lied to you. I didn't lie to you before. I just lied to you now. Duke was the first to 20 wins in that famed, we were on the 20-year anniversary, 1998-99 team.
It's a terrible trivia time. You don't even have your facts straight.
No, I just I didn't actually there. So, but I got him straight now. But Hall of Fame coach. Who's the other one?
We've got Hall of Fame coach. So we've got Mark Few, Rick Pitino.
No, it was never Pitino.
Okay. Was it Roy?
It was not Roy. North Carolina has never been the first. Well, Roy has won. Again, I'm lying to you.
The worst trivia time ever.
Wow, this is not only is this a terrible trivia time, you are correct, and it's three coaches, not two, because Kansas did it in 96-97 and 97-98. Okay, so Roy did do it. There is another Hall of Famer that applies this. I promise the next trivia time I won't screw up this badly.
The other Hall of Famer, Bill Self.
Correct, but. Okay. It is Self at Kansas 07-08, and then it is Self at Tulsa in 99-2000. Tulsa was the first to 20 wins that season. So there are three coaches that have done it. I don't know why I didn't think there were three when Kansas clearly did it in back-to-back seasons. Those were those really, really awesome Kansas teams, mid to late 90s, neither of which, though, even made it past the Sweet 16. But anyway, Houston's the first one this season, and I've got a historical look at the seeds that those teams ended up with, where they finished in the NCAA tournament, their records, et cetera, et cetera. I happen to think Houston's one of the 10 best teams in the country because of its defense, and maybe this portends well for the Cougars. We'll have to wait and see, but just keep an eye on that going forward. They are a standout team in the American.
And that is another edition of Trivia Time, where we sometimes ask questions we don't even know what the answers are.
I know. Might be.
Shouts to Devin Downey. Shouts to Chester, South Carolina. Shouts to Terry MF and Teagle. He's the legend. Shouts to Larnell. And if you haven't subscribed to the Island College Basketball Podcast yet, I don't know what you're doing with your life. Please go do that. You can do it via Apple Podcasts. And when you do it, what we're requesting is that you rate it favorably. That means 5 stars and nice comments. You guys have been terrific in helping us with that. The subscriptions are up. The ratings are up. The nice comments are all over the place. So thank you. If you are somebody who's already done it, well, I appreciate you. We appreciate you. If you haven't yet, we still appreciate you, but not nearly as much as we appreciate the other people. But you got the power to change that. You just have to go subscribe to the Island College Basketball Podcast via Apple Podcasts. So go do that. And we're going to talk to you again on Friday morning. Until then, take care.